You really have to get to know someone. Courtship, the whole idea of courtship is such a boring, dated thing, but I am a big fan of it. I think most of the relationships I've had that have not worked out or had started really passionately and then crashed and burned were because I didn't spend enough time getting to know the person. That's an interesting comment. Who do you think said it? Pop singer Madonna. That's who said it. Can you believe it? Courtship. Well, it is a rather old-fashioned word. And I wouldn't have expected Madonna to even know the word, actually. But I think it's one we need to revive today. What is courtship? I looked it up in my dictionary, and this is what it said. Courtship is the process of courting. Great. Thank you very much. That's helpful. I would say this as we start this morning. Courtship is the process of getting to know someone with the intent to marry him or her. It is intentional. Genesis chapter 24. We read the remarkable story of Isaac and Rebekah. They had to get to know each other through the eyes of others. They had a courtship by faith. How do you practice a courtship by faith? Now, we don't live in the world of arranged marriages like Isaac and Rebekah, although many parents have entertained the idea. There are, however, good principles of courtship that we can apply to our world today. Let me say this, we need our culture to get off the dating merry-go-round and learn that every date is a potential mate. The problem with serial dating, and I see it all over our culture, and I certainly deal with people in premarital counseling, the problem with serial dating is that two people get emotionally involved before they truly know each other well enough. And they go from one relationship to another. And I think there are some great principles that we can apply to our lives today from the story of Isaac and Rebekah. Now, many of you may be married, but we too can learn from these principles as well, and certainly as we give advice to others. So, first principle this morning, how do you practice a courtship by faith? And by the way, I'm going to say that every marriage is on faith. Every courtship is on faith. We'll talk about it more here. But first principle, how do you practice a courtship by faith? First of all, start with careful planning bathed in prayer. Genesis 24, verse 1. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, "Please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. But you will go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said to him, "Suppose the woman is not willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came?" Then Abraham said to him, "Beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house, from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, 'To your descendants I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there." So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. Then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. He arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. He said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac, and by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master. All right, Abraham is about 140 years old. Isaac, by the way, is 40. God has promised to raise up a nation through Isaac. Abraham is trusting in that promise. He is trusting that God will guide. He sends his servant 450 miles back to his homeland to find a wife for Isaac. The servant was probably, we're not told, but was probably Eliezer, Abraham's trusted chief of staff. The first thing I notice is the importance of heritage. Abraham knew that it was vital for Isaac not to marry a Canaanite woman, for she would take his heart away from God. Now, today, of course, parents don't control this matter, but we must realize that a Christian heritage is important. Missionary dating sometimes works, but is never wise. It is far wiser to make sure that the person you court has similar moral and spiritual values, because those are vital for building a marriage. And they are vital for us as we build our marriages. Those core spiritual moral values are essential, that heritage. The second thing I notice is how this whole quest was bathed in prayer. Abraham has been praying. He continues to pray. Eliezer, his servant, bathes this entire trip in prayer. He arrives at the well in the city of Nahor, and he's praying, but I suspect he's been praying all the way through this trip. By the way, it's an interesting note, isn't it, that Abraham instilled in Eliezer a tremendous faith in God over the years. Eliezer is now trusting God. Singles, whether you're young or older, are you praying before you ever date? You better be. Dads, moms, are you praying not just for your daughters or for your sons, but for their future spouses before you even know them? You'd better be. It is your responsibility before God. At our wedding, my dad performed the ceremony, and he told the entire congregation that he had prayed for Janie long before he ever met her. From the time I was a little boy, he had prayed for her. He just didn't know her name. I have prayed for the men I do not even know since the time my girls were very little, who someday might marry my daughters. Dads, if you are not praying now for the future husbands or wives of your children, people you have not even met yet, then you are not doing your job as a parent. It is part of your responsibility before God to bathe the process in prayer. And it is part of each person's responsibility as you date, so to speak, today, or better, the word court, to be praying all the time regarding the people that you come in contact with. And for those of us married, it is wonderful to be praying for each other all the time. Third, I noticed that Eliezer in his prayer sets up a test for the right woman. Now, some have said this is like Gideon's fleece. It is not. This is completely different than Gideon's fleece, which was basically an act of unbelief, really, when you study the context. This was a test designed to determine the marriageable qualities of the woman, of the spouse. I'll say more about that. I'll explain more in a minute. But for now, realize that you need to be praying that God would show you the right qualities in the person you court. These qualities are way more important than your attraction to one another. You won't build a lasting marriage on an attraction. Sexual attraction will never produce a lasting marriage. Our culture views physical attraction, that feeling we get, as a primary test of a marriageable person. Are you attracted to each other? Am I attracted to you? Are you attracted to me? Do we have that tingly little feeling? Oh, great. Then you must be the right person. But this is one reason why we have such a problem with failed marriages in our world today. The character qualities of the future husband or wife are way more important to a lasting marriage than any attraction, because attractions don't last. They come and go. Feelings don't stay consistent. So, second principle this morning, look for the character qualities tested by life as you consider the person you might marry someday. Verse 15. Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. So we were told here, of course, that this is one of the kin of Abraham, but the servant doesn't know this. The girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had had relations with her, and she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please let me drink a little water from your jar." Test is being set up. All right? Let me drink a little water from your jar. She said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. See, courting is all about intentionality in the process. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half a shekel and two bracelets for a wrist weighing 10 shekels in gold and said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Again she said to him, "We have plenty of both straw and feed and room to lodge in." Then the man bowed low and worshipped the Lord. He said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers." So he sets up camp near the local well or spring, knowing that culturally the young woman would come out to draw water in the evening, and he's going to watch. He's looking. There's great intentionality here. He's on a mission. He examines the young women as they arrive, and he set up this test in prayer before God. And the test is designed for God to show him the marriageable qualities of the woman God wants for Isaac. But you know what? We can apply these same tests to men as well. Let's not just do it to the women, because the same tests apply to them. Are you considering the kinds of qualities that will make for a lasting marriage relationship? And I think there are three tests in these verses that we can use today in courting a husband or wife. First of all, does she or he care about the needs of others? Does she or he care about the needs of others? Eliezer sees Rebecca. She's beautiful. That's wonderful. Physical attractiveness is there. So he runs over to ask for a drink of water. He's a stranger, of course. She can see his entourage there, his camels, his servants, because he didn't travel 450 miles by himself. There's a whole group out there. He obviously came from a distance. He's thirsty. She could have reasoned, you have servants, you could certainly draw the water yourself. What are you asking me? Help yourself. Why doesn't he just get his own water? But you see, it's a test. He is looking for someone who is gracious, who is considerate, who is kind toward a stranger, and won't just brush him aside. Sure, he could get his own water, but he's trying to find out what is in her character. And one very important marriageable quality in either a husband or a wife is the ability to care about others and their needs and their feelings. The opposite, of course, is selfishness, you know, self-centeredness, selfishness. And if a person is self-centered and doesn't care about your family, for example, or your friends, or your needs, or the needs of those around them as you're watching and observing, if they aren't sensitive and considerate to the needs of others around them, watch out, because they will bring that same selfishness into the marriage. Look for somebody who cares about the needs of other people, who is kind and considerate. Those qualities will make for a good marriage. Second, does she have a strong work ethic? Now, these aren't too romantic, are they? But they are the kinds of things that will make for lasting marriages. Does she or he have a strong work ethic? So he's determined that the woman will be someone who offers to water his camels without him asking. He's not going to ask for that, but that she will offer voluntarily. She will offer without being asked. That's very important. Now, just for a moment, a single camel can drink about 20 gallons of water at one time after a trek like this. If she had a one-gallon container, she would have had to make 200 trips from the well to the camels. 200 with 1 gallon of water to water 10 camels of a stranger. It would have taken, I don't know, an hour or two anyway to do all of that work. You see, the servant is trying to determine if she is a hard-working woman or just someone who will want to live off Isaac's wealth, because Isaac is very wealthy. Abraham is a very wealthy man. No gold diggers, please. Is she a hard-working woman? A strong work ethic is a marriageable quality. Not just for women, guys. Even more, just as much, we'll say, for men. Does your potential partner, your date, study hard in school or play and party all the time? That's something to notice. Playing and partying may seem great. It may be lots of fun. You don't build a lasting marriage on playing and partying. Does your potential partner, your date, stick with and hold jobs or quit easily and change all the time? That's a marriageable quality you can test by observation. Those are important parts of the courting process. Third, does she or he have a warm and welcoming spirit even when inconvenient? Servant gives her some tokens of the wealth, a gold ring, two bracelets of gold. It was probably the beginning of what would be the dowry, as we will see. I'm sure that got Rebecca's attention, but then he asks if there's room in her father's house. She identifies herself as a relative of Abraham's and warmly welcomes him and his entire caravan. Again, this is a large group of people. This is not one person. This is a large group of people. Come on to the master's house. She's hospitable. She's welcoming. Now, when she started out that evening to go get water, I am sure that it was not in her plan for the day to have a caravan with 10 camels and a whole bunch of people welcomed home to be cared for that evening. But she offers the resources very quickly. A marriageable person, a husband or wife, is not someone who is moody, selfish, focused only on his or her goal or agenda for that day. A good marriageable quality is the quality of being inconvenienced without complaint. The quality of being inconvenienced without complaining. Why? Why is that such an important marriageable quality? Because I'll tell you this, marriage is full of inconveniences. That's life. You're looking for someone who doesn't mind being inconvenienced for the sake of the other, because marriage is filled with inconveniences. So look for someone who is willing to be inconvenienced. Will they join in what your family is doing or only want to do what they want to do? Do they care enough to be inconvenienced by you when you want to do something different? That's a good test. You see, courtship is about getting to know, intentionally evaluating a potential wife or husband. If that sounds cold, it's because our culture has taught us wrong. We need to discern these kinds of character qualities in a person before we get too emotionally involved. In our Western culture, we want to fall in love, be smitten, have that tingly feeling, and that's what makes it. And it's not true. We don't want to think about qualities and character. And what does this tell me about that person? But those are the things that make a marriage work. And all of you married people know that is true. And we're always working at it. Third principle, trust God's guidance as you navigate the circumstances. I'm not going to read this lengthy section here, beginning verse 28 down to verse 49. It's basically a repeat of the story. Eliezer is telling the family, Rebecca's family, the story. It's a repeat of the story, but it is how God guided him through this process to her. And he gets to the point down in verse 48. And I bowed low and worshiped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham. You see, this is all about how God is guiding the process. Who had guided me in the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. So now, if you are going to deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. And if not, let me know that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. It's very clear that the servant trusted God to guide him through this whole process, through all of the circumstances of his journey to this point, and all that remains is for them to see it too. If not, okay, fine. God's closed the door, and we'll move on. Now, obviously. Once again, we do not follow the cultural practices of the patriarchal period. And I'm not advocating that we should. We don't have servants who will do this for us. But we still must trust God's guidance in this process. We make it a matter of prayer, we're evaluating, and we are trusting God to guide us to the right person. We have to navigate the circumstances of our lives by faith and trust God to lead us through those circumstances. I grew up in Pakistan, and in terms of my parents, the intention was to spend the rest of our lives there. But my mom got very, very ill, almost died, and we had to return to America, and they wouldn't let us go back, so Dad took a pastorate up in Old Town, Maine. And there I met my wife, Janie. Now, I didn't know she would be my wife then. And there my brother met his wife, Cindy. He didn't know she would be his wife then. Circumstances. Who's in charge of those things? God. God's in charge of the fact that we didn't end up back in Pakistan. God's in charge of the fact that we traveled all the way up to Old Town, Maine to take a pastorate, or my dad did. God's in charge of how he brought my wife's family to faith and to the church there. God's in charge of all those little circumstances. Trust him. Trust him. He'll guide you through that process. So, are we praying for God to lead us? Are we trusting that God guides us as we navigate through all of these circumstances? Or are we simply sort of wandering through life hoping to be swept off our feet by love sometime? Daniel Jones, the editor for the New York Times Modern Love column. I've never read that, actually. Maybe you have, I don't know. But he has had access to the love lives of tens of thousands of strangers through his column. And he's noticed two trends recently. A few years ago, many young people, he said, wanted to hook up without getting involved in a relationship at all. But now that's changed. He's noticing that people want intimacy without sex, or without even meeting the person. They want closeness. And the entire relationship that he is dealing with often as he writes his Modern Love column, the entire relationship is based on a virtual connection through instant messages, email, Skype, FaceTime, all of that kind of thing. He calls these relationships soulmate in a box, or SMIAB for short, S-M-I-A-B, SMIAB relationships. Now, this is not a Christian author. This is just a secular writer on love, okay? SMIAB. And he notes that most SMIAB relationships end up failing. They do not last. And he tells the story of one woman. This woman had been thoroughly enjoying a very intense SMIAB relationship with a man hundreds of miles away, all through their computer, phone, that sort of thing. And their bond had grown so intense that they decided it was finally time they ought to meet one another. And so she traveled to meet this man for a weekend. One Friday, she drives 9 hours to meet this man. They're going to spend the weekend together. It went okay, she said at first, but soon it became clear that their online chemistry was gone. It had dribbled away to nothing. Now that they were actually together, it was as if they each were the person they had been trying to escape from in the first place with their online relationships. Before long, he began sneaking glances at his cell phone. That might be a little tip-off, you know, when you're on a date, right? He began to excuse himself and get involved in his laptop computer, searching for what he was missing, that intense relationship, that emotional fix. Why do people desire it and then pull away? This secular writer says it's because we're afraid of vulnerability. Vulnerability. The writer says that's the worst part of the whole love game, putting oneself out there to be judged and rejected. So when we get the chance to hide through social media, we can edit and control. We're freed from much of that anxiety, and we're fooled into thinking this may be a better and truer way of having a relationship, is it? No, it isn't at all. It's a terrible way to have a relationship. Because the only way you can have a relationship is through being vulnerable with one another and learning to love one another in that vulnerability. It's first a spiritual journey, and you have to trust God to guide you through those circumstances. And in marriage, we have to trust God to guide us through the circumstances of our lives as we grow to really know one another in the relationship we have. Fourth principle this morning: say I do as an act of faith for the future. Verse 50. Then Laban and Bethuel replied, "The matter comes from the Lord." They recognize that God is guided, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken. When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. The servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments, gave them to Rebekah. This is the dowry, of course. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. Then he and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night. When they arose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master." But her brother and her mother said, "Let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10. Afterward she may go." He said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master." So he's asking that she go right now. We're leaving. And they said, "We will call the girl and consult her wishes." Then they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." Thus they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse with Abraham's servant and his son. They blessed Rebekah and said to her, "May you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them." Then Rebekah arose with her maids. They mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. So he lays out the dowry. You ready to go? Whoa, wait a minute. This is a little fast for mom, right? So let's consult Rebekah. It's up to Rebekah what she wants to do. "Will you go with this man to a whole new life?" And she says, "I will go." She will go to a world she has never seen, with a man she does not know, to marry a husband she's only been told about. Now that's faith. That's faith. This may be the most significant quality of Rebekah. She would go by faith. Incidentally, this is the same quality that Abraham and Sarah had many, many years ago when God called them from Mesopotamia to a world they did not know. They went not knowing, but trusting God. And here's Rebekah, willing to go not knowing, but trusting God. That's faith. And I want to tell you that faith is a very high priority in any marriage. Every marriage, we talk about marriage being based on love. Folks, marriage is based on faith. It's based on faith. Husbands and wives must be men and women of faith. A wife today may not have to go sight unseen, but she still says, "I do," on faith. A husband today may not have to marry a woman whom he has never met, but I guarantee you he still says, "I do," by faith. Nobody, and I mean nobody, knows what the future holds as you enter marriage. As I counsel couples who are getting married, I ask them, what would cause you to break up this marriage? Think of all of the possible scenarios that might happen. And we sometimes have that kind of discussion. Why? Because you can't even begin to think of everything that might happen. Life is full of twists and turns, changes, and nobody but God knows what the future holds. So every I do is said on faith for the future. Faith in God. Because you have no way of knowing what will come about. What will your life be like 10 years from now? You can't know. What will your husband be doing 10 years from now? Take a guess. You can't know that. Where will you be living 10 years from now? You can't guarantee that. When we marry today, we marry on faith. Marriage vows are an act of faith for the future. How do you know if he is Mr. Right? How do you know if she is the right woman for you? You're going to take her on faith. There's no other way. You pledge your love on faith. In a recent study conducted by ChristianMingle.com, Christian singles between the ages of 18 and 59, so it's a pretty good span here, folks, were asked, would you have sex before marriage? The response, 63% of the single Christian respondents said yes. Now, these are people professing faith in Christ. These are Christians. 63% said yes, they would have sex before marriage. And by the way, it is very common for people to do that today because they're testing out the compatibility. In response to this survey, Kenny Luck wrote, in my 30 years of youth and adult and young adult ministry, this is as unfiltered, direct, and honest as a question and answer can be. In practice, Christian young adults have become sexual atheists. Sexual atheists. They do not believe in God, that God can actually control, guide, and direct their relationship with a woman or a man, their sexual union. They really don't trust God for sexual relationships. They are, he says, sexual atheists. They just don't believe God knows best when it comes to marriage. That's pretty blunt, but he's right. The census reports a 72% increase in the number of cohabiting couples since 1990. 72% increase. For many people in our culture, living together before marriage has been compared, is so common today, it's been compared, and I've had it compared, to taking a car for a test drive. You wouldn't buy a car without testing it out. Why would you get married without testing it out? That's a very common argument today. The trial period gives people a chance to discover whether they're compatible or not. Here's the problem with the car analogy. The car doesn't have hurt feelings if you take it back to the used car lot and decide not to buy it. The analogy works great if you're the driver. It stinks if you're the car. And we're talking about relationships here. And by the way, trying it out doesn't work anyway. Every study that has been done demonstrates that marriages built on the foundation of cohabitation prior to marriage do worse, not better, in all of the criteria that we can use. When a person says, I do, That person is trusting God for the future. It is an act of faith that God knows best, because only He can tell the future. We can't predict the future. No matter how hard we try to test out our future spouses, we stay together in marriage by faith in God. Fifth courtship principle: choose to love because it leads to feeling love. Verse 62. Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahai Roy, for he was living in the Negev. Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "He is my master." Then she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. In other words, how God had guided him. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So Isaac's not living at home, by the way. He's living in the Negev, not back in Beersheba where Abraham lives, some distance away. By the way, if the name Beer Lahai Roy sounds familiar, it's because we've been here before. Isaac is living in the very place that God appeared to Hagar when she was running away from Sarah and told her to trust him with her life. That's where Isaac is living. How ironic. Notice the qualities of Isaac that are important. He is meditating in the field during the evening, and the text seemed to indicate that this is a very common practice for Isaac. He is a man of prayer, a man of faith in God. The implication, by the way, as I read this chapter, is that Abraham did not do all of this on his own without Isaac. Isaac was a willing participant in this process of trusting God for his future wife, and he was praying about it, and now prayerfully waiting for his bride. They meet, they're married. Verse 67 says simply, he loved her. That's it. He loved her. Where does love come from? It's not an attraction, because feelings of attraction come and go in every single marriage. I am amazed how often a couple will come to me that I have married and be surprised that the feeling isn't there at some point in their lives. That's because feelings come and go. They change. They're up and down. And a marriage will not last if it is based on feelings of attraction only. Now, we want the feelings at times, certainly. It's wonderful. But it cannot last based upon that. Love is a what? Choice. Love is a choice. The feelings follow the choice. That's lasting love. You make the decision to love someone, and the feelings come out of that decision. That is, the lasting feelings of love come out of that decision. So we have it all backwards. We're looking for that special feeling first, and because the marriage is based on the tingly feeling, when we lose the tingly feeling, we want to opt out on the marriage, and that's our culture. Now, there is a sense in which the attraction draws us together, but it better go beyond that attraction to a choice to love, or it's not going to last. Marriage is not based on tingly feelings. You know it, I know it. Those are nice, but they don't build a lasting marriage. Marriage is based on the choice to love someone, and the choice means that we will act lovingly toward that person no matter what we may feel at the moment in the marriage. The beauty is that when we choose to love, the feelings follow. We can apply that to all of our lives as married people. You choose to love, so you choose to act lovingly even if you don't feel like it that day. That's love. In his book, Sacred Marriage, Gary Thomas writes, "If we're serious about pursuing spiritual growth through marriage, we must convince ourselves to refrain from asking the spiritually dangerous question." What is that? Did I marry the right person? That's a terribly dangerous question to entertain. Did I marry the right person? A far better alternative to questioning one's choice is to learn how to live with one's choice. A character in the Ann Tyler novel, A Patchwork Planet, comes to realize this late. The book's 32-year-old narrator has gone through a divorce, now works at an occupation that has him working with elderly people. And he is struck by the elderly couples who have been married for 50 and 60 years. And he comes to a profound understanding about marriage. He says in the book, "I was beginning to suspect that it made no difference whether they'd married the right person. Finally, you're just with who you're with. You've signed on with her, put in half a century with her, grown to know her as well as you know yourself or even better, and she's become the right person." That's an insight into love, isn't it? That's Isaac's kind of love. She becomes the right person because I choose to love. That's true for all of our marriages too, folks. We choose to love. And so, the feelings of love come later. Every year, the National Marriage Project out of Rutgers University publishes their report entitled The State of Our Unions. December 2012 State of Our Unions report notes the following statistics. More than 40% of children now are born out of wedlock, unmarried parents, 40% of kids. Between 1970 and 2012, the annual number of marriages per 1,000 unmarried adults decreased by more than 50%. There's a huge trend to not being married today. The divorce rate today is about twice that of 1960, although it has declined since peaking in the early 1980s, partially because people just are choosing not to get married. So that's going to change the divorce rate, obviously. More than 25% of all children live in single-parent homes, 25%, compared to only 9% in 1960. The number of unmarried couples has increased 17-fold in the last 50 years. The study concludes that we are witnessing a striking exodus from marriage in our culture today. And one historian writes this, "The scale of marital breakdown in the West since 1960 has no historical precedent. At no time in history with the possibility of Imperial Rome has the institution of marriage been more problematic than today." Whoa, that's a powerful statement. That's the culture we live in. That's the culture our young people are growing up in. A good start to correcting those kinds of trends is to revive the concept of courtship. The old-fashioned practice of courtship. I don't mean at all a return to arranged marriages. Don't go off that direction. Parents are known to make bad choices too. But I do mean that courtship should be a part of our lifestyle in our culture today. By the way, even Isaac and Rebecca made choices in this marriage. It wasn't just the parents. Courtship is the process of getting to know someone with the intention of possibly marrying that person. It is a time of intentionally observing the qualities that make that person who he or she is and choosing to love them for life. And once married, we commit to that choice.
for better or for worse, as we say, which a lot of people aren't saying anymore in marriage vows. Till death do us part, another thing people aren't saying in many marriage vows. Courtship means that we trust God in prayer to guide us in love before we commit ourselves in marriage. For He knows best. You can trust Him with your life and with your marriage. Father, thank You that our trust is in You. It is not in each other. We will fail each other. We will struggle. But we can trust You perfectly with our lives, with our marriages. Help us to trust You today. In Jesus' name, amen.